Hello, everybody, and welcome to MilSurp World Podcast, the podcast all about military surplus. Today, we're going to be discussing the MilSurp market for 2023. But we are joined today by Danny. Say hi.
Oh, hello. Hello.
And I have blanked on everybody else's name. This is always a scuffed intro.
We have Jake and Cody.
Jake and Cody. I know their names from Discord. I don't remember everybody's name otherwise.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. For the get-together, I almost made name tags that have everybody's Discord and real name.
Yeah.
Because I'm terrible with names. So it's hard enough remembering two kind of names
here. All right. So Jake's joining us from the pool. Cody's joining us from his Vetterly cave. You guys can unmute. Yeah. Say hi.
Hey, everyone.
Howdy.
Jake is a kind of a class act right now. I think this is the first ever podcast guest from the pool.
Yes.
Which is pretty sure you're smoking a cigar, just living life right now.
Oh, he's got his Roth.
Oh yeah, I got the Roth Krinka by the pool. That's just that's living the high life right there.
And it's my pool defense gone.
Yeah, exactly.
I have multiple cool RTI M95s beside me, so that's my defense. I'll just throw them at the invader.
Yeah. I was gonna say fixed bayonet maybe, but
no, I don't have any bayonets.
You have none
at all? I don't have any. I have a Siamese Mauser bayonet, and I actually have an M9130 bayonet, but I don't have an M9130.
Yeah. Why not get like at least one bayonet?
I have.
Oh, he could have.
What's the Portuguese MP34? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think it's just.
It's got a special name.
Just that, right?
It's always got a special name. But I have a bayonet for one of those, which is actually an M95 bayonet, just slightly modified for the MP34. Oh, I also have a Lee Navy bayonet. So the Lee Navy bayonet's pretty cool.
Oh, okay. So you do have one bayonet for one of your guns then. That's the craziest thing to me, man. If you're so like into M95s and stuff, why wouldn't you have the bayonets? Because there's like some pretty neat like variants of M95 bayonets.
There's a couple of them.
There's like the standard one, but then there's the one that's got the little like
something
called a little. Yeah. The Quillian. Yeah. And then there's the one that has the sight. Like it has an actual.
Yeah,
like,
there's a sight, like a secondary, you know, sight on it. Yeah. There's quite a few different variations. The problem I've always run into is that whenever they show up, they tend to be pretty expensive, and I can't ever justify paying prices for them. Like I'm not talking like ridiculous like $400 prices, but like $100 to $200 is what I normally have seen them come up for near me, and I'm not going to pay that much for a bayonet. But
what about if one was free and it came with a rifle that was $300?
Oh, well, see, that was also $300. Yeah, that was also the first rifle I had seen that weekend, and I wasn't gonna take all of my money and throw it away on the first thing I saw.
I'm just always gonna give you a hard time about that. Now it's just not gonna happen.
Well, I committed the sin, right?
Oh yeah, the gun show send.
I walked away.
You walked away from the deal, man. That'll get you.
All right, we'll do intros here. Cody's been on before, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Cody's been on.
But Jake.
Me, Jake.
You've not been on, have you?
Never.
Okay. Go ahead.
It's an honor.
Tell us.
Yeah, we have the two questions that we ask everybody the first time on the podcast. The first one is, how did you get into military surplus? And then the second question is, what was your first military surplus firing?
I have two good answers for that. One was, well, let's start with the first military surplus, which was the first gun I ever owned. Russian SKS. 1998. $350, which was kind of a lot for back then, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That got me into semi-automatic firearms and really my first firearm. The interest in military surplus was a book that my aunt got while she was visiting us in Newton was Guns of the World. And I have that book, actually. I bought it. It's a manual, an old book. I'm going to have to send you guys a pic or something. But I got that book and I just read it a ton when I was in high school and looked at all manner of different guns, and mostly were World War II era, some post-war era stuff. And I just got really interested in that. And of course, the World War II era stuff. So, gosh, that was 1999, really. Didn't really get a lot of the stuff that I've had until really the past 3 years, I'd say. So it's been about 3 or 4 years when I started buying some of the stuff that I've got. Ironically, when I got my CNR license, the first gun I bought, actually, when I had that, was an antique M39 Thin Mosin, which didn't even need to be on that CNR, so much for that. But that was the first one that I got when I had that. The first one that I actually had to put on that CNR was a Enfield number 4 Mark I, right after watching Dunkirk, the movie, in the theater when it came out. Just had to buy one of those. Great movie, great gun. I like that movie. Say what you will, but it got me to get a number 4 Mark I. I think that was the first one I got on the license.
Nice. Cool. That's cool. Yeah, that's a really interesting. When you said like Russian for your first one, I thought you were going to say Russian Mosin, because that's really like the gateway drug, I think, of milsurps. But yeah, Russian, yeah. SKSs are, that's SKS. Yeah, that's out there. Yeah.
They've gained in value, but my gosh, 1998, that gun is kept up with inflation. And the first Mosin I got was, I posted on the Discord, it was $39. It was in rough shape. I sold it to a friend of mine, actually, on the police department in Wichita, Kansas. And I need to see if she owns it now. It's my cousin-in-law, and see what she did with it. But my next Mosin I got, an M44 as well, was $90, of course. And it was a typical Reaper, but in good shape. But yeah, that price has since climbed quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah, they definitely keep up with inflation at the very least, you know, because they they're good investments. Everything else aside, there's some milsurps that maybe aren't the best. They were so cheap for so long. I probably never would have said back then that like Russian Mosins or even most SKSs would be worth that much. Because I remember one of the first gun shops I went into, they had a whole like rack full of Yugo SKSs for, I don't know what they were. They were like $80 or something a pop. Like they were so cheap. It's crazy. We're dating ourselves a little bit now with this, but yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to purchase K31s at $300 a piece when Gander Mountain here first opened up. It's just like, I don't need them. So.
Yeah. I remember seeing Russian or Finnish Mosins, like M39s and stuff, at gun shows for like $400 a piece. And I remember specifically thinking like, oh shit, that's too much. I'm not going to spend that like on a Mosin, you know? But yeah, those are, especially with the books coming out and stuff, probably finished stuff might see a little uptick, but we'll kind of see. I don't know. Sometimes books don't always up value gun values a whole ton. Like I haven't seen stuff like the Japanese sword book that came out that was a Hit Stamp Publishing did. I don't know if that's upped sword values a whole lot, so I'm not quite
sure. It's a pretty niche market to begin with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some of those are pretty niche that Hit Stamp does. Like the Japanese tobacco, like that's a pretty, that's like niche of niche kind of subject.
Yeah, so yeah, it's definitely going to be, you've got to think about like how niche the original subject is before it's going to affect anything majorly.
Yeah, so we'll see about Thin Mosins, I guess. But sorry, that was a little digression. We don't do that too often on this
podcast. No, we don't. We always stay on topic. That's why I got yelled at for telling Danny to stay on topic.
Is that why you stopped? I kind of know. Right. I haven't really noticed that you've yeah. Yes.
The people in the YouTube comments decided that I was being too aggressive and telling Danny to stay on topic.
Oh, man. Yeah, my poor wife.
We've had our introduction, so usually we go around and say the last thing we bought.
Recent. Hey, did we do the purchases since on the last podcast?
No, because we had all those people on, and we had like a rotating group of people.
Oh, okay.
So it was a little bit more of a big group podcast, and we were just talking about the event. But
Because I know
we talked about some of the stuff we got at the show. Like I talked about getting an M95, but I have purchased something since the show. So how many times are you going to light that pipe, man?
Oh, you just do it periodically, man. It's just part of the fun.
Obviously, I don't know enough about pipe smoking. So last thing I bought, another M95. Everybody shocked? Shocked faces? No? All right. It's a 31M, actually. It's the Hungarian conversion. It was one I was missing.
Oh, yeah. You got it from a Discord member, right?
I did. I got it from a fellow Discord member for a good price. So very happy with it. It's one I was definitely missing. It was a big hole in the collection. It did not have the front sight protector, but funnily enough, a different Discord member had sold me a front sight protector, which I had kept, just in case I ever ran across a 31M without one. And I'm going to tell you what a goddamn pain in the ass that is to put on. It is a sheet metal, stamped sheet metal, and we're talking eyeglass screws. That's how tiny these screws are. And it's, instead of it being like a case of where you just screw it in and it just kind of squeezes it together, right? It kind of just tensions it to it. You actually have tiny little nuts on one side, the screw on the other side, and then you have two spacers that are just little thin pieces of metal on both sides. What a gigantic fucking pain in the ass. And then the sheet metal pieces is actually in two pieces. It's not just one fucking piece of metal. So no, it's literally, this sight protector is like the most basic fucking thing. And it's like seven or eight pieces and that you have to have three hands. I hated it. If I didn't have my vise that I bought to hold that fucking thing in place, you couldn't have done it. And honestly, I would never do it again. What a gigantic pain in the ass. Just because of how tiny little fucking screws and everything it was. I don't understand why they did it that way. All the other sight protectors, the Bulgarian, the Austrian ones, they're all just pressed on. They just snap on.
Yeah, that's crazy being so different from other Mannlicher sight protectors, but also like just other sight protectors in general.
Yeah,
just
it's basic. Totally like, overly complicated.
Man,
it's.
I wonder if the Hungarians are worse than the Germans with their.
It's two. It's overcomplicated so stuff. The sight protector itself is two pieces, the base and the actual protector, and then you have to line them up, and then it's a spacer on either side, so two spacers, and two screws and two nuts. So it's two, four, six pieces to do this thing. And it has to be perfectly lined up or it won't fucking work. And you have to squeeze it together because the screws are just barely long enough to go through. So it has to be like clamped into place and then you have to squeeze. I had to hold it in place with the needle nose pliers with tape wrap around them, hold it in place and clamp it. And then just tiny screws. It was a pain in the ass.
Does it feel fragile or anything?
No. I don't think it's a fragile thing. It's just incredibly complicated for what it is. Like, it's really overly complicated. I don't understand the reasoning behind it.
That story sounds like when I took my foul bayonet apart off the gun. You ever messed with the foul bayonet?
No, not the bayonets themselves.
Not the band. Sorry, I'm talking completely different. The bipod of those guys, the spring loaded.
Oh,
it sounded like it's a pain. Story though. It was an absolute mess to put back on bipod, not band.
Yeah.
Was it harder than the recoil spring?
I did both, and yeah, I did have a launched recoil spring.
Yeah, everybody does that once.
Yep.
I did that once, yeah.
If you've got an FAL and you've taken the recoil spring out, it has launched. And
like if you don't really know what you're doing when you do it the first time.
When you're like, oh, whatever, it's just a spring. It's not going to be the boom. There it goes. That was the last time I was allowed to take guns apart upstairs because it flew in front of my wife's face.
Yeah.
That was fun. I did it twice. The first time it hit the wall and she was like, what was that? And then months later, I did it again and it flew in front of her face.
I didn't know you did it twice. You didn't learn your lesson the first time?
I thought I had it. Like I had the screwdriver, I thought I had it tension enough, and then it just slipped out of my hand at the wrong second, and then the bolt actually went right in front of her face, so it just went. Shit.
That's one of the things I like refuse to take apart now. Is like the recoil spring of an FAL. It's not quite as bad as the recoil spring on a Johnson, but like it's still what a pain, dude. Like my Frommer stop. I will never fucking take that thing apart again. It's just terrible. It was, I can't even, it was so long ago and I'm pretty sure I've like wiped it from my memory.
You've got a PTSD experience from it.
Yeah. There's something going on with it, but I will never take it apart again.
It's the same. It's like when I purchased, there's two rifles that I purchased that I was told, don't take the bolts out or don't take them apart, which is the Lee Navy and the Figaro. It was like, just don't do it. And I've been told by I have a friend in Portugal and he's like, it's not that big a deal, but it is difficult the first couple times.
So
we'll go around. So I bought a 31M. Danny, what was the last thing you purchased?
Well, from the show, I bought six things from the show. I think I said the two. I bought the two Jungmans.
Right. We made fun of you for that, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. I bought a Mukden Type 38 carbine. And then I got an Astra 300, a German accepted, made in 1942 Astra 300. An FN 1906. And I got another Bayard Piper.
Oh, but you also got that starter pistol too, right?
Oh yeah. Technically, this thing is a non-gun, but it's a Sauer and Son M33 starter pistol. It's real funky, so it's like it's a single loaded deal. You single shot load it, and then when you pull the trigger, the whole thing moves back and slams forward. It's pretty funky.
It's pretty cool.
It's a real thing. It was made like 33 to 1940, something like that. This was sort of an impulse buy. It was cheap.
Yeah, so I think he was
kind of had to get it.
I think that was the guy that sold you a Jungmann, and he was like, $50?
Oh, yeah. It was something like that. Yeah. It's like, okay, yeah, sure. I've never seen one before. I'm a sucker for J.P. Sauer. So,
yeah, I knew you were. That's why I thought you were going to get it. But that's definitely a weird thing. It took us forever to figure out how to.
Yeah, yeah. How it works.
Yeah.
Because it has a safety on the starter pistol, and the safety, it's on this side and it like moves the whole slide forward. I'll do it on camera for those watching on YouTube.
Oh yeah.
So I think it just moves the slide back out of battery where it won't fire. Like it's pretty basic safety, but it's kind of neat. Never seen one before.
It's really small to get it too. It's like super tiny.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Very small. Yeah. Maybe I'll let my kid play with it when he's old enough or something, since it's like a non-gun. I don't know.
Can you get cartridges for it? I guess it would just be like blanks, right?
It's some random like 4.3 millimeter blanks or something like that. So I don't even know. Some of those things, like these trainer rounds and starter rounds and stuff like that, it's like your old European things. You probably have to, it's like a specialty even in Europe. So I probably have to order it and be a whole thing, but that's not super worth it, but yeah, I got those six or seven things at the show. So it was a good show. Yeah. Cody, Let me guess what you got. What you got recently? Let me think. It's Italian.
Carcano.
What'd you get?
I did actually order one of those. I got it. One of the veterally short rifles, but wound up sending it back to RTI to get a swap. So they had a couple things wrong with it, and they said they'd just swap it out. Like, it had the wrong sights from a different rifle on it, and a couple other missing things, so I'm waiting on that. It's funny, like, when I ordered it, it shipped out in 2 days, but then when I sent it back to them, they said it'll take 2 to 4 weeks. So I don't know. I guess I got unlucky. So I don't actually have that, but the last thing that I bought before that was one of the $199 Gras infantry rifles when they did that sale.
Oh, how'd that turn out?
It turned out really good. The one I got had, the only thing it was missing was a cleaning rod. And I actually have it here. So, has the whole rear sight on there too.
Oh yeah.
The extractor and everything. So, got a solid one. It's got good rifling in it. It's pretty strong rifling. Just missing a cleaning rod. So, you can't complain, with that for $199. So, now I just got to shoot it.
So I know RTI kind of gets poo-pooed, and, I feel like we've sort of painted you a little bit as an RTI apologist on the podcast. They seem to have done you right with what you got there. And I do think it's super cool that they let you go through their Vetterlies and like catalog them, you know, because that's just a really cool thing to do for historical purposes, you know, like to collect that data.
Yeah, they've been really great to work with, and, you know, certainly very appreciative of them giving me a chance to get over there and get hands on with some of the rifles for documenting things. It's been great.
Yeah, cool.
I would say I'm not an apologist, but I'm a realist.
RTI enjoyer.
More of a realist. Like, I'm not going to expect good things, but I'm also not going to be super upset at the prices I'm paying, you know what I mean? I'm not
going to strike out. You kind of know.
Right. But I'm also not buying more high end items. I'm buying literally the stuff that's on the bottom of the list in terms of price.
Well, yeah. M95s.
Right. Well, and he's buying the Carcanos and the Vetterlies. He's buying the Carcanos and the Vetterlies. He's right there with me.
That's true. 6.5 Vetterlies. I can't think of anything that's like below that, honestly, as far as like
in terms of value price. And I mean, Turkish Mausers.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's like different for me is I actually have a lot of interest in the like Second Italo-Ethiopian War, and just even the first, just the actual history of military conflicts there, you know, from the late 1890s up to World War II is actually interesting. So a lot of the really oddball stuff that people get out of RTI and they're not happy with, I find it really interesting. Like when you get those, some of the videos that Forgotten Weapons did, the Ethiopian oddities, where they have these like really one-off, like weird modifications of stuff. I find that really interesting. And people, like, I saw a post of someone who got one of the Vetterlies and it had been completely modified with a different magazine and all sorts of stuff, and he was all upset about it and took all the modifications off and tried to rework it back to original configuration.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, I get it, but I find the actual history of that type of stuff super interesting. So some of the stuff that comes out of RTI that might not make a lot of people happy, I find that really interesting.
Well,
yeah, that's cool if you're already interested in like the Ethiopian like conflict and stuff like that, because I mean, that's literally straight out of it. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I noticed on some of the M95s that have been coming out here recently have been posted on Facebook and Reddit that they have the carpet tacks in them. Have you seen that? Or the shoe tacks? I'll show you. I got one on one of mine.
Yeah, I've seen those. And I see people that they'll take all the tacks out and throw them away. Off.
And I'm like, what? Like, somebody somebody did that. Like, it's part of the history of the gun. I'll see if it'll show up on my... There you go. These.
Yeah, like, that's cool. That stuff's cool. If you actually have interest in that, you know...
They're
that.
Just tacks, and they've been, like, smashed in there for whatever reason, just for fun.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you guys know why they did that?
Why do I have a brass heart in my M86? Somebody got fucking bored.
Oh, I mean, obvious. That's classy AF, dude. I mean, that's...
Somebody got bored and they weren't going to get in trouble, so they did shit. You know, it's like...
But what about the random tax, though?
It could just be decoration.
Yeah, it's just individual stuff.
Oh, maybe it's kills.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it is.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to just very quickly do a little ad here for this book. Obviously, it's not my book, but this book came out earlier this year, and it is fantastic. It's called Abyssinian Conquest, and it's about the Second Italo-Ethiopian War by Philip Jowett. Tons of really good pictures in here that are not on the internet, and lots of context for the stuff coming out of Ethiopia. So,
yeah, some neat pictures.
Reading this book will give you a lot of insight into why the guns coming out of Ethiopia are the way they are and the way that they fought, which was really interesting. So
we were talking about this in the Discord, right?
I would highly recommend this book.
We talked about this in the Discord, right? Because you posted a bunch of pictures, like they're all barefoot.
Yeah. There's tons of photos, which are really neat.
Like legit military.
Everyone was barefoot.
And they're barefoot. And they're just walking around
barefoot. Yeah, so the actual Imperial Guardsmen did have boots as part of their uniforms, but they didn't really like them, so in a lot of cases, they just wouldn't wear them. But everyone was accustomed to not wearing shoes anyway, so they really opted not to in most cases. But I think that probably one of the most interesting things is from that book is just getting an understanding of how the other forces actually were organized, where it was pretty much local chiefs that were responsible for gathering fighting forces. So a lot of the people fighting there against the Italians in the 30s were more loyal to their local chiefs than to Selassie, right? You have a lot of desertions and a lot of switching sides from some of the Ethiopian groups. And there's no system at all for the arms and ammunition. So it was a complete free-for-all on what gun you got and what ammo you got. And people would have a gun and incorrect ammo, so it was really interesting.
Yeah, all the pictures you showed, there was a lot of just a mix of whatever. Like there was M95s, and then there was Vetterlies, then there was French stuff, like the Gras we saw, and the Lebel, and just a bunch of random.
A decent amount of the Czech stuff too, like the machine guns.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Czech stuff got everywhere. Yeah.
Where do I pick up that book?
I think I just ordered it on Amazon. You just Google search. Do what?
What is it called again? Sorry, I think you're about to say
Abyssinian Conquest. So if you just look that, it should pop up on Google. But fantastic book. And like I said, if you are somebody that enjoys the stuff that comes out of RTI and finds that stuff interesting, the book is fantastic and totally worth it.
Yep. Abyssinian Conquest, the illustrated history of the Second Italo-Ethiopian War, is currently $46 on Amazon. Well, you could get it used for
$36. Cool. Well, Doc, you want to talk about your recent acquisitions?
Well, as I'm in the pool, are these cicadas too loud for you guys? Do you hear those suckers? No. They're pretty annoying.
I don't hear them.
Sweet, good. the purchase that I got at that show was actually from one of my partners who snagged for me an antique and a Winchester 1873 lever action in 44-40. And that's going to be a birthday gift for somebody. So keep that on the down low. So, but that was my purchase at that gun show. And I think that was my last purchase. The purchase I made before that gun show would have been the, it was a gun broker deal. And I think, yeah, I think it was that one. I got two kind of close together and they were, I very ironically, both Fox Studios, the movie studio, marked guns. I didn't know a lot about movie studio marked guns until I bought this Berthier. So it's a Remington Berthier that was Fox Studio marked. And my wife thought it was pretty cool that they did that. So I'm like, well, let's bid on that. And we actually won it. And it wasn't actually a bad price for a American Berthier Remington. So we got it and got that from ISIL. But it wasn't too bad of a price. I actually already had a Remington Berthier, but it had been sporterized. It's one of my projects that I'm working on to unsporter. Well, kind of unsporterize. I bought a stock from the guy in Poland. What's his name from Fox?
Fox Militaria.
Yeah, Fox Militaria. That was many years ago. I bought that stock. He sent it to me. I need to put it on. I bought a bunch of things like the, I think technically it's called the nose cap, the front stock cap / stacking rod combo that goes on those things. And I was going to try to unsporterize that sucker. But I picked this up and it's a wonderful looking Remington Berthier, Fox Studio marks on the stock and the receiver and barrel. And after that, actually, Poulin Auction House, which was at that gun show and had all the cool stuff that we were all looking at, had a Fox Studio marked Springfield trapdoor that I bid on and actually won. It wasn't a bad price for a trapdoor, and I didn't have one actually, so I picked that up, and they both kind of got shipped at this close to the same time. So we got two Fox Studio marked guns. So now the Wallace household is now full of Fox Studio marked guns, a trapdoor Springfield, and the Remington Berthier of all things. And I checked it to make sure it was still an 8 LaBelle. I have some 8 LaBelle rounds in the basement, so I checked it to make sure it wasn't converted to something else. But that was kind of a fun purchase, but it wasn't at that show. But at that show, my partners got that Winchester, which is definitely old. I don't know if you'd put that in the bucket of milsurpers or not, but we have it.
That's cool, man. Yeah, you're getting dangerously close to starting like a movie studio gun collection, man. Because I think it's three's a collection, right? So you just need one more.
Danger and, close.
Yeah.
We'll see if I can convince Kim. Maybe we'll get another one. There were many. Actually, I had to research it because how I typically buy things is I buy them and then research them after the fact. And
guilty.
Kind of fun, but I found out that a lot of movie studios have marked their guns that way, and they were really fully functional guns. And really interesting that they did that. No way. Well, I'd say there was no way that they did that, but obviously recent events, it's obvious that sometimes they use actual functioning guns. I won't mention it more, but but gosh, for Berthiers and things like that, that was probably a long time ago. Who knows what movie or show that was in? I don't. That was just a gun broker auction, but you could kind of surmise there was something that Fox Studio did with that thing that was probably on film somewhere, somehow. but it's a really nice, the other, like I said, the other Remington Berthier was sporterized, and I got a pretty good deal on auction as well. And I was going to try to unsporterize it, but now I have two, as how it goes. But those were my last three purchases, actually. So one at the gun show and two that weren't birthday presents at the various auctions.
And some solid pickups there then. Yeah, movie studio guns. That's something that's never been on my radar. I've never really even thought about, but that's kind of cool. I'm pretty sure that's how people get into collecting, like some of this odd stuff. They just happen to run across a couple examples. Oh, this is cool. I do the same exact thing. I'm really guilty of picking up a gun. And then, like, I'm not super interested in putting all the time and effort into researching a given thing, especially because, like, if a pickup is random, then, you know, maybe you just hadn't because it was a random pickup. You know, was on your radar, but you come across something at a good price, pick it up, and then that sort of ignites your interest into, you know, going down that certain rabbit hole. So
that's how this happened, and it was kind of maybe a fairly average price for an American Berthier Remington, but that Fox Studio marks that they had was pretty cool and pretty interesting. So we didn't probably super overpay. Who knows? But
yeah.
That was a cool gun.
Yeah, I'm actually Googling right now, list Fox Films, that World War One Fox Films. Death Watch is one.
Danny.
Yeah.
You can't assume that they used it accurately. It could have been
movies always use guns accurately.
It could have been used in a Wild West movie for all who fucking knows, you know. They just needed a prop.
Okay, so movie studios. So when they spend, you know, millions of dollars on a movie, they wouldn't use a gun incorrectly.
No, that's why in the movie Patton, there's all of these period correct tanks.
Oh well, that's not why. They just didn't have German tanks to use. We blew them all up.
They didn't have American tanks either, Danny. They used Pattons the whole fucking thing.
Well, I mean, those. Yeah,
they didn't have Sharpens. So they just used Pattons.
Yeah. But those older kind of movies.
It's not just, I'm sure it was used something. It could have just been a hunting rifle in a background of a shot somewhere. You never know. And I guarantee you they didn't keep track of it that way either. So there's no fucking way to find out.
That is true.
We can go down the rabbit hole trying to figure out what movie.
Unless it was held by, like,
it's a Berthier, so it could be on a World War II movie as well, because the French used them.
It could have been held by somebody famous, and then somebody on the crew stole it.
Yeah, see, that's another thing, is how did they get out? Because does a movie studio sell a gun? Like, I've never heard of that happening.
I'm sure there's been...
Maybe in the 70s.
I'm sure that shit just disappeared, too.
Maybe in the 60s or 70s, I don't know.
I don't know the history, and that's something I'm interested in, but think about modern movie studios probably not doing that anymore. But going back to Dunkirk, one of my earlier movies that inspired some Milsurp collecting, I mean, genuine World War II era stuff. I particularly love the scene where they had the British soldiers escaping and had the French soldiers defending whatever village that would have been around Dunkirk, using Mach 36s. And I saw that, and the iconic bolt handle and everything. And I'm like, yep, I love that they use that, Christopher Nolan. So they got that.
He's a big stickler for that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering what they would do gun wise, but yeah, I think he did it right. Cause they were using SMLEs, the British were, right? Mostly at the time, which was correct. They should have been.
And something I'm not familiar with is uniforms, but we watched some videos on the historical accuracy. I forget which YouTube channel it was, but they did a pretty good job with some of the uniforms and the wool coats and jackets and stuff. So apparently he did pretty good with that, too. So
I wouldn't be shocked if he had some of the reenacting community help with that, as far as they filmed it over in France, didn't they?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be shocked. They have a very large reenacting group there, especially for World War One.
Mm-hmm. And so, truth be told, so I met, well, I didn't meet Nick, one half of the Milsurp duo, part of our Discord server. My wife and I went to visit Kansas City last weekend, and we hung out with that guy. And we were talking about movies a little bit. And we think that one of the most accurate depictions of Dunkirk was actually this a little bit older movie, Atonement, if you've heard of that or watched that. Put that on your watch list if you haven't. It was a little bit more gritty and a lot more populated of what that beach probably would have looked like during the Dunkirk evacuation. But I think the Dunkirk movie, Christopher Nolan, did a really good job with the little ships. We love that history a lot. Just amazing. But kind of digressing from the firearms history of that era, but Atonement did one of the better jobs, supposedly, of kind of depicting that. And it's a pretty expensive looking scene and kind of a fun movie. We rewatched it a couple weeks ago, my wife and I. It's one of our favorite movies too. Gosh, I think we watched it in the theater, if that dates us a little bit. Don't look it up, but it was a while back.
It's an 07 movie is what it says.
You just call them out like that?
We were dating at that time, thank you.
It won an Oscar for Best Original Score.
Mm-hmm.
And was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, we were dating, by the way. So, yep. But we watched it in the theater, and that was a memorable movie. A good one for Dunkirk.
Interesting.
Yeah. I looked it up. Got Keira Knightley, 2007. So
James McAvoy is the lead.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He looks super familiar, but I couldn't tell you like what movies he was in off the top of my
head. Oh, James McAvoy?
Yeah. Oh, wait. X-Men.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Professor. And then
Professor X. He was in Glass.
Glass.
Split.
Yeah.
Split. Yeah. Glass. Professor X.
He was in The Last King of Scotland as well.
Yep. Yep.
I don't think I've seen that.
Oh, that's a good one. That's about that crazy, crazy dictator in Africa.
We saw him live in the West End, and it was about Jekyll and Hyde. And yeah, he's a good one. But watch Atonement if you haven't. That's a good one about, I won't give it away, I won't spoil it, but that's a good movie about that Dunkirk, that whole era.
Yeah, the Last King of Scotland, Danny, is about the Idi Amin, the Ugandan warlord.
Yeah, that's some interesting stuff right there.
He's pretty famous online as a meme. He's got there's a video gif of him laughing on a boat, and it's used quite often as like a laugh reaction. And it's actually from a documentary. It's a person asking him the question about why he doesn't believe in the Holocaust, and he's laughing as his answer. So kind of a dark video, but it's become like a meme joke reaction gif. And
of course it has.
Yeah. It's a semi-popular GIF on the internet, but every time I've ever seen it, I'm always like, "That's a weird thing that happened there."
That's cool. So wait, what was our topic today?
Today is the market, current market status.
All right,
Danny's keeping us on track today, so now we get to yell at Danny.
Yeah, I know.
So I did something kind of dumb, crazy, weird to help us keep on track of this. I went through the past 30-day listings completed on GunBroker. I went through 500 listings, and I categorized them and organized them based on pistols or rifles. And I only included guns that were not broken, missing parts, not listed as gunsmith specials. They were not sporterized. They had to have been militarily used and easily seen. I don't know handguns as well, so I don't know, like, this specific serial range means it was used in this specific, you know, acceptance mark or whatever. If it listed it as military used on the thing, I listed it in my notes. So I have a good subsection of stuff, and I started with the highest number of bids. So it wasn't the highest price, but the highest number of bids. So this is like stuff that people were fighting over. The majority of the time, the bids go between 15 to 30. That's usually the range of the amount of bids. Some of the stuff got into the 60s and 70s, meaning that there was an actual fight for these items. A lot of the stuff is like what you'd expect, especially for the handguns. I'm sure we can probably guess the top three most common ones that were sold in the last 30 days. Who wants to guess? Top three.
1911.
Aha!
Luger.
Aha!
Tokarot? Or P-38?
Boom!
Okay.
That's it. That's like 70% of the handguns, guys.
Oh, man.
It's a lot. However, the highest priced item was not a 1911. It was a Colt 1903 that sold for $6,575. And everybody's probably going, what the fuck? That is a papered and documented handgun to a lieutenant general. I don't have it written down who it was, but it's a documented handgun from World War II. It was his personal sidearm, and it was fully documented and everything, pictures and all. So, like, this is a fully papered lieutenant general's handgun. So that is why that went for that insane amount of money. There was a 1911 A1 right after it for $5,500, so that was number two. It would have been the number one. However, breaking the list of 1911s at third place was a high power, as an FN high power that was German marked. So Danny was pretty excited about that. But anyway, this was just to kind of get an idea of where everything's sitting in terms of at least what's going on GunBroker. And then we can also talk about what's going off of GunBroker right now. Well, we can go by... How do you want to do it, Danny? You want to go by regions of the world? We can go to, like, American guns, and then we'll move to, like, Central South America or Commonwealth or whatever.
Maybe regional.
Okay. Let's see. So, North America, so that'll be Canadian and United States... And I guess Mexico. United States stuff still remains high, at least based on my documentation. M1s, M1 carbines, Colt 1911s, A1s, obviously. Colt 1911 A1s all tend to be very high in terms of price. No real degradation of price. There was just an announcement the other day for the CMP is having another round of 1911s coming out. So another round of CMP 1911s hitting the market. So we'll see another influx of those. Right now, the cheapest place to buy an M1 is probably through a private sale of somebody that doesn't know that they've gone and skyrocketed in price, or buying them from the CMP directly. M1s are just going to go for obscene amounts of money online anymore. Anytime they try to fight over them, it's just insane. 1911s are the same way. I don't know anything about 1911s in terms of rarity of parts, collectability of anything like that, but I can tell you that based on the data that I pulled off of GunBroker, it's crazy what they're going for right now. On average here, hold on. On average, in the last 30 days, a 1911 A1 or a 1911 was averaging $2,500. Now that's either World War One or World War Two. There's a range of price there. The highest of the end was $5,500. The lowest was $1,500. I don't know the specifics, and I didn't grab everything, obviously. There was 4,500 listings, and I went through 500 of them. So, and that took me 2 days. So I wasn't going to grab everything. So I didn't get the cheapest thing out there, I'm sure. But it's pretty expensive. The Colt 19, the M1917s are also pretty expensive now as well. I've noticed that is in this discussion or this looking this stuff up. Danny, any input on that one? On the U.S. stuff? You looked at any of the U.S. market?
Not really. So the 1911 Sitch, I think, is kind of weird with CMP releasing those. I think you really kind of have to be a 1911 guy, or at least like me looking at stuff, you have to not just assume that this is now like some sort of intact gun from the war, that now it's changed hands several times. Maybe it's been refinished. Maybe it's mixed parts. You know, that sort of thing. I know a couple guys, you know, just ordering from the CMP, you can get like a real rare pistol, apparently, that's like a super high dollar gun, just depending on the letters that's stamped on the frame. But it's kind of the 1911 situation now is a little odd because of these CMP guns. But I don't know what that's going to do long term with collectability and stuff. But I don't collect a whole lot of American stuff. So to me, that's just sort of, foreign.
Honestly, I'm priced out of the market. I'm way priced out of the market for those kind of things. Mm. Like, it's not something I can afford.
Yeah, I don't find them worth it.
Looking at the rifles, the overwhelming majority of the rifles were M1 carbines. The two highest sold was M1A1s, the paratrooper versions, for around $4,000 each. Those are legit paratrooper versions, though those are not recreations. So one of them was from Gray Blanket. So shout out to our friend Gray Blanket out there. 1903s also averaging about $800 to $1,000. 1917s on the low end still. They're definitely still on the low end, between $500 and $800. For a 1917, which I think is still a good price if you can get one that's in pretty good shape. I think that's still like a decent price for a U.S. MilSERP. They still don't have the value potential of the 1903s or the M1s. M1s anymore, you're looking at $1,000 plus, which to me is just insane in terms of value. If you bought these anytime in the 90s or the early 2000s, you can make money hand over fist with this right now. You have an insane return on investment.
Well, if you think of like every other semi-auto rifle from World War II and what those go for, and then compare that to,
M1. But there's definitely a lot more availability of M1s than the other ones.
Yeah. Thanks to like the CMP and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. If you're going to buy an M1, I would recommend the CMP. As far as that goes, yeah, it's not going to be necessarily be like all World War II original, but it's going to be a lot cheaper, especially if you're wanting something to shoot.
Yeah, that's the best way to do it. Not buy it from a guy at a gun show who's marked it up 50% and is trying to flip it.
Yeah,
definitely. Not like that. But
Canadian,
they were extremely expensive at that last gun show at the Missouri Valley. Those M1 carbines. They were, well, one of the sellers was.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, they're like, carbines are pretty sought after. They're like highly collectible. And yeah, the prices on those are just always kind of up there. Like, you know, carbines start now at like $1,200 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought this up to Danny when I was discussing with him the other day about this data set that I have. It seems like there was a Mexican Mauser collection that went for sale in the last 30 days. It was all posted by the same account, and all of these are heavily fought over. There was a model 1910 that had 71 bids, which is insane. I'm telling you, the average for these bids on these lots is between 15 and 20. So 71 is a huge fight. It ended up at $1,000, which for a Mexican Mauser is insane to me in terms of value. But that wasn't even the highest. There was a Mexican model 1936 that went for $2,700.
I was watching that 60, auction very
60
closely.
Bids, 60 bids on that one. So that's a heavily fought one. It was in great shape. I did see that. It was in beautiful condition for a Mexican Mauser. That was definitely a weird hiccup in terms of that. Most of the time, the Mexican Mausers show up there in horrible condition. They tend to go for between five and six, maybe a little bit more. It depends. It's heavily dependent upon condition for the Mexican Mausers, for sure.
And there's some rare models, like very uncommon models, like that 1936.
And it does seem to be, you have to find the people that want them, and there's not very many people that want them. And if you find them, though, they will fight over it, for sure. It definitely seems to be that case.
It just takes two. It just takes two guys with the money to throw down to bid something up like that. And I did throw a couple bids on that 1936 Mauser because I've been wanting one of those.
It was a really pretty.
It was nice. It was nice. I think it had the front sight protector, maybe a sling still.
So that was definitely a rare piece that showed up and it was all from the same account. So it seems like there might have been somebody that had a Mexican Mauser collection that sold off for here recently. So interesting to see those pop up. They don't pop up super often.
Yeah, no, they don't.
And then we'll move to South America, I suppose. There wasn't anything Canadian. We'll get to some SMLE and number fours from the Commonwealth side when we get over to Europe. But South America, a lot of what you'd expect. Mausers, mostly Argentinian, Chilean, in terms of let me just look through here my list here. There was a Haitian model 24, which was very interesting to see. I don't know if you saw that one, Danny.
I think I did. What it went for.
That only went for about $600, which they're extremely rare, just because obviously Haiti did not have a huge military, so they don't have a whole lot of stuff. They also don't have a lot of, there wasn't a crest on it. It just said on the side of the receiver, it says like something in I think it's
like rep, REP, Haiti.
Yeah, it says something. It says like Haiti on it. I think it might be French, the French name of Haiti or something. Right? Wasn't Haiti a French colony?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so I think it's in French on the side. Model 1891 from Argentina and a Chilean model 1935. Pretty much standard in terms of between $500 to $600 there. Not a huge amount of money. Fortunately, I guess you could say, is that South American stuff tends to be undervalued in terms of, at least on the United States military market. Milcert market. So, except for the handguns, Argentinian handguns tends to still go for crazy amounts of money. The Mannlicher handguns, the 1905s, went for, there's a couple of them on the data set, and they were about $1,500 a piece. They still go for crazy, crazy money. I don't understand that. It's always the 1905 Argentinians that show up in the United States, and they always go for $1,000 plus every time I've ever seen them. And they usually don't have any of the markings. They've been scrubbed of the crest. So I don't get the love of that. I think we're losing Jake in terms of a picture. He's getting darker and darker over there.
You can see the time lapse here. My wife is on the lounge table. She knew about Haiti's history, actually. What did you know, honey? That was a French colony. How did you know that? I didn't even know that. Anyway, she's an amazing historian, too. Anyway, I'm going to have to transition to the basement, I think. I'm going to disappear from the video for a bit and mute myself, so stand by.
All right.
Okie dokie.
South America, though, tends to be undervalued in the Milsurp world still, which is, I guess, a good thing if you're wanting to buy. The rare models tend to go for more money, just because you have the models that are very common that most of those guys have already gotten them. So the rare models that pop up do tend to go for a lot more money.
You know what I think is a criminally undervalued South American Mauser is the Argentinian 1909 cavalry carbine. Those are like pretty good prices. I've seen a few of those that are like $400 to $500 recently, which I'm always like, well, how's this still like for sale at that price? It's just they're so you can find them pretty cheap, and they're more like short rifles, even though they're called cavalry carbines. They're more like a short rifle length. I think it's like a 23-inch barrel, something like that. 7.65, which is a little harder to find, but I mean, great quality guns and everything. I think they're pretty cool overall. That's one of those pretty good deals. Some of the guns, some of the Latin American Mausers are kind of creeping up there, but you still find some good deals. Mm-hmm. Just kind of depends on the random. Sometimes like a random model will just not go for that much, like the Brazilian 0834s or something like that.
Yeah, none of the Brazilian ones like, came in the list. Just Chilean, Argentinian, and that one Haitian model. The Haitian one I'd never seen before, so I didn't know they had a specific model that I'd purchased.
Yeah, that's cool. I saw that one for some reason. I didn't bid on it. I have a rifle from their neighbor. It would have been kind of cool maybe to have a Haitian one to go with it. But
yeah. I didn't know that was a thing. So that's pretty neat that that was at least a thing that showed up. All right, we'll move over to where do you want to go next?
European.
That's what happens when you're in the bathroom.
I'm a pan-European. Yep.
So that happens when you're in the bathroom. So in terms of European, we have quite a bit to choose from here, obviously, in terms of, what's going on. Russia would be considered European still, right?
Yeah, we'll throw them in with Europe, I guess. Yeah.
All right. What about Turkey? Is that Middle East?
That's another, they span Europe and Asia, technically Turkey. So it's kind of like,
all right, well, I'll.
We can say they're the European too. Yeah.
I have Middle Eastern stuff too. We can talk about, so we can actually go to include them in the Middle Eastern stuff.
Okay.
So handgun wise, dominated by German handguns, as you could expect. P08s still going for obscene amounts of money. Hold on. Let me just grab the rest of these.
Lugers are gonna Luger.
Yeah, Lugers go for obscene amounts of money, anywhere from my highest on the list here was $3,200, all the way down to the lowest one that I found was $1,000. It was complete mismatched. It was the seller described it as a put together piece. So it looks like it was probably just a bunch of different parts put together into a functional handgun. But there was two of them that was done by the same seller. And they were both like the some of the parts were World War I marked. But definitely just a mix master in terms of pieces. But they were $1,000. So that's your cheapest Luger on here. So if you're wanting a shooter, $1,000 for a Luger isn't terrible, which is
it's kind of hard to find one that cheap, but yeah, the cheaper ones like the Vopos and stuff, you can get it for about $1,000. A friend of mine, he wanted to buy a Luger for his brother's birthday, but he was like, I have a budget of $1,000, find me a Luger for $1,000. And so I was looking for him for a while, and it was kind of surprisingly hard to find one like about in that range that wasn't garbage that is actually shootable. So I like how it blurs out your drink.
I don't know why it's like
an alcoholic beverage or something, and blurs it.
This is we're not
see if it blurs my Kirkland.
No, it doesn't, because you don't have the waters. I have the background blurred, so it does. It I'm drinking.
Oh.
I'm drinking liquid.
Forget you have your
liquid death. Okay. So it's not. It's not an actual tall boy. I don't actually drink, so. Some weird stuff that showed up on the list. Lottie L35 showed up on the list. which is a Finnish handgun that went for $3,000. But really, P08, P38 dominated the list, Germany dominating the list. Webley revolvers, quite a few of those showed up. All different marks, mostly Mark IVs, but also Mark Vs and Mark Sixes. I don't know the difference between them, so don't think I can ask me. A couple of Enfield number 2 Mark Ones, which is another revolver, but those showed up a bit. Some Viz 35s. But the Webleys all went within the range of $600 to $800, which isn't terrible, I didn't think.
Did you differentiate on caliber for the Webleys?
No, I didn't specify caliber. I didn't go into full detail on that. I didn't really go into super hard detail on it. But the Webleys did go roughly all around the same time in terms of price. $800 to $600.
So it's tricky. Some of these guns, we're talking very general here, of course, but right, some of these guns are very, there's like little details in them, but the big one with Webley's is caliber.
Right. I'm trying to be broad here because obviously we can't specify down. And I also didn't,
you could definitely go into the weeds with this for a general thing.
Some Czech guns showed up, in this list, CZ-27s. And CZ-24s at the bottom of the price category, still underappreciated in terms of price. We're talking $400 to $500 for a CZ-27 or a CZ-24. Some Italian Berettas showed up in here. Some Italian guns for once showed up on the list. 1934s, they showed up for around $500, so they're still towards the bottom of the list of dice right now.
They're creeping up.
Yeah, they are definitely trending upward. There was a one for $550. Some Russian and Soviet Nagant 1895 revolvers, which is another one of those things that was like, how the fuck did these go up in this high in price?
They're like the worst.
Yeah, just one of the worst fucking things. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst fucking things ever made. The highest one went for $600. And I'm just like, what the fuck?
Was that like a World War
I? 1920. It was 1920 dated. It was very, very early Soviet marked. So I could see that. Because that's right in the middle of the revolution. Cause I don't think that's kind of, I can see that going for a higher price. Got some, something in my beard. Yeah.
Check a little bit of lunch.
Yeah. I don't know what that was. That one came with a holster. Ooh. Some Austro-Hungarian stuff. So something that I kind of know what it is. Some Steyr Hans, $500 to $700. A Roth Krinka showed up for
What did it go for?
$1,200.
Yeah.
$1,200. A French 1935A handgun that was German marked that went for $1,200.
I want one of those.
Fun story.
Can you see it?
Yeah, we can see it.
That guy is an A serial prefix. And I don't think the guy that was selling it on Gunbroker knew what that meant, but
I usually don't.
Yeah. So I got that for less than $1,200, but that was hard to find.
Yeah. Yeah, those early ones are pretty neat. If it's early, like it's pre-war, that's just kind of neat because you know it was involved in the war somehow. Probably captured. Here's the thing. A lot of people, sorry to digress here for a second. Here's the thing about a lot of the captured German arms from the war is that, like, especially early on before, like, the Waffen-Ampel offices were set up, the Germans didn't mark all the stuff they captured. They would just, like, guys would take it, guys would use them, units would use them, whatever. Like, they wouldn't mark all their stuff. I think people have this perception that like the Germans marked everything and they're super, you know, whatever. But yeah, no, like it could very easily, if it's a pre-war captured gun, like it's a pre-war French gun, very easily it could have been German used or German inventoried at least.
That's, you know, what happened with like the M95s, because that those that was all taken over as part of the Anschluss. So
yeah, like,
those didn't get manufactured, they just took them.
Yeah, if it doesn't, yeah, if it doesn't have a you know, like a dirty bird on it, then it's just nobody cares, because you can't really prove it. But like a ton of those were. But I think with French collectors, particularly like pre-war French stuff, you know, draws a little bit more.
Wasn't much, you know, in terms of French handguns. We're still on the handguns here. Nothing really standing out. There was a French, actually, speaking of, there was a Lebel revolver, the 1892, which was the lowest of the handguns, $400.
All right, something had to be wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know the details of these. I just wrote down information based on the listing. So I don't know what exactly the cause was for the reasonings for these things.
Yeah, no. Broad strokes.
I would have bought that, but I paid a little bit more than that. But yeah, I needed a French World War One, but... it's not on the wall.
There was a couple of Swedish M40s. I don't know what those are. Do you know what those are, Danny?
Yeah, it's like the Lotties, the Swedish Lottie.
Those went for about $1,000 a piece. There was three or four of them, all about the same thing. Oh, I forgot. We didn't mention this. There was a really weird handgun that was South American, which is Argentinian. That was a 1911 that Danny knew about these, but this apparently, so Danny was talking to me about it, that Argentina purchased the rights to produce their copy of the 1911, but this listing said it's not an Argentinian production 1911. They bought a small contract of them beforehand, and then they decided they would produce them domestically. And this particular handgun that was for sale is from the original Argentine contract with Colt. So this is like a 1920s, mid-20s, Argentinian Colt 1911, but produced by Colt and not Argentina. So it was very specific and very like, oh, this is a really niche thing. And it went for about $1,000. It was actually a super cheap 1911 compared to the rest of the group.
Yeah, I think that's really cool, but that's probably goes into the, you know, South American stuff just isn't quite as sought after.
No, it was, yeah. What's crazy was it was a legit like Colt 1911, but just because it wasn't U.S. property stamped, it was essentially thrown into like the commercial numbers.
Didn't win any World Wars, so didn't. Wait, Argentina was on the joint, I think it was in World War II, right?
Yes, but this was in pretty the 20s. Sure. This was a late 20s purchase. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So they purchased some from Colt. They set up their own production and they made the 1927 Colt Sistemas. And then those are too expensive, buying the licensed 1911. So then they just started making the Ballister Molinas, which have like zero part interchangeability. I think barrels and magazines, I think, is it. Only thing that's interchangeable, maybe recoil spring, something like that. Just the parts that need to be swapped. And they made the Ballister Molina and stopped paying royalties. Just to save money. So those are kind of neat. I think everybody knows about the Ballisters.
Yeah. So just a handgun recap for Europe: P08s, P38s, 1911. Or I'm sorry, P08s, P38s still dominating the market in terms of the United States. Still dominating the market in terms of price and popularity. Great Britain, the Webleys are pretty common. Somewhat down at the bottom of the barrel, the Nagant revolvers still showing up. Czech stuff is still showing up at the bottom in terms of price, but it is seems to be climbing up. And then you get random different things like Poland or like the Swedish, or the Finnish guns showing up in there. But those tend to command higher prices just because they don't really show up that much in the United States. Moving on to the rifles. Once again, as you'd expect, the German stuff is definitely moving around a lot more. It's also on the high end in terms of price. The highest model that we had was a Gewehr 98, 1916 Kornbusch. Oh, Jake has left us on accident, I think. He'll probably come back here in a minute. Excuse me. I don't know a lot of the manufacturers for Germany, but I do know that Kornbusch, whatever the hell to pronounce that, is a rare manufacturer. They were a low manufacturing amount, so they tend to go for a lot of money.
Yeah, you could really go into the weeds with this German stuff and like all the little... Dude, it's like it could be one little mark. It's got one little letter. It's got one little star on it or whatever. And all of a sudden, you're like, what the fuck? Why'd that go for twice as much?
That was a $3,800 rifle there. The most expensive rifle, though, that sold in the last 30 days that I was able to find was a Lithuanian model 1924. But actually, model 24L, because that's what's listed on the receiver.
Yeah.
It was about $4,000. So really close to that Gewehr 98. So that's a very high-end. Another one of those really rare, hard-to-find, most people don't know it exists kind of things. A weird thing to show up at the top five here, though, was a M9130 showed up in the top five. It was a 1942 original sniper, not a reproduction sniper. It was actually matching and correct, and everything was like actual sniper rifles. So,
1800. That's my guess.
3,200.
Oh, jeez. 3,200 for a PU sniper?
Yeah. It was a gray blanket. That's why.
I was going to say, it must have been actually used at the gigs.
Yeah.
Jeez. It was a gray blanket, so it was well advertised. It was well known, and it was an authentic sniper. A lot of the snipers that show up are ex-snipers that somebody's put a scope on, but this was not the case in this instance. It was an actual sniper rifle. So,
imagine paying $3,200 for a Mosin.
Somebody did. That had 44 bids as well, so that was a pretty fought over piece. The first K98K, or Jake's back, the first K98K to show up, I didn't get the manufacturer on it, but it was $2,600. Pretty pricey. I don't know what was about it. It didn't specify anything special about it. Didn't even specify matching. I don't know. Don't know what happened there.
We'll just say German. German K98K, that's what happened.
A 3340 did show up in the list, which is something that doesn't show up super often. That went for $2,000. Something that showed up that Danny thought was actually a good buy, somebody had a good buy in this list, was an SVT 40, which was Finnish marked, and it went for $2,000, and it came with an extra magazine and an extra stock. Don't know exactly what was going on there, but that's actually a pretty good price.
Yeah, that's good.
Sight unseen, it seems to be a good deal. Whenever I see a gun being sold with another stock, I assume that the stock is being sold with is like the original stock that somebody fucked with, and then it was put like a reproduction stock on it, or another stock that's not the original stock and it's not matching, but it's correct, or you know. It's, I always assume it was something that was kind of messed with it like that. And who knows if like the mag that came with it was a reproduction original or whatever, because they make repros and stuff like that. But Finnish SVTs, when I see those at shows, like everybody's asking like, you know, at least high twos, $3,000, something like that for them now when you see them anywhere. So I think $2,000 for a Finnish marked SVT is good in the current market, man.
Yeah, that was definitely, it was in good shape too from the pictures that I saw of it. It actually didn't even list in the, I don't think it listed in the description that it was, in the title that it was Finnish. It said it in the description, but not in the actual like listing description, the title. It didn't say finish marked. It just said it down in the bottom. When you actually looked at the pictures, it had an SA stamp on the receiver. So interesting that it went for probably why it stayed in terms of down, in terms of they didn't properly list it. So,
Yeah. That kind of stuff happens too.
Another weird one that showed up, was a Hungarian 48M, which is the Hungarian produced M9130s. Beautiful condition. This is another one of those ones like the Polish M44s that you'll see that are unused, basically produced and then shoved in a warehouse somewhere. That one went for $1,400. But like I said, that one looked like it had just been produced, like it had been rolled off the line yesterday. So I can understand maybe that going for a decent amount, but it is still a Mosin. Completely post-war. Like, this is a 1948 production rifle or something like that. So, like, very strange, but they don't show up very often in the United States. You don't see them super often, so maybe that's part of the reason why it was going for a decent amount. There was a Soviet SKS 1950 for about $1,000. So there you go, Jack. Not a lot of K98Ks actually in the list. Either they didn't get a lot of bids, or I'm not sure, but maybe just in the last 30 days there wasn't a whole lot. A lot of Swedish stuff, a lot of M96 and M38s, but those are staying between $700 and $500, so not a lot of that.
I still think those are a good deal. Those went absolutely bonkers for a minute, like last year, I think, after, because there was like the big like trio of videos that came out on M96s. I'm blanking on the big Nine Hole Reviews, and two other channels did M96 videos. And in Nine Hole Reviews, his Swedish M96, it beat the Finnish M39 as the most accurate rifle put through their firing course. So that was sort of a big deal, I think, to them. And for a while, M96s, every M96 sold was like going for pushing like $800 to $1,000 there for a minute.
There was an M96 that was World War One era, 1917 marked, that went for $1,000. But all the rest of them were under $700. So between,
yeah, that's kind of interesting why it went for so much. I wonder if it was finish marked or something.
I didn't specify anything else. It just said, I don't have any other notes on it.
It could have been one of them hidden deals.
Yeah, there was a couple of Finnish rifles, M28s and M91s, $900. It's pretty standard anymore. Right around that mark, between $950 and $1,000. $900 and $1,000 is about what they're going for anymore. Some K31s showed up as well, $800 to $600. You're still going to expect a pretty decent amount of money on those anymore. Crazy that, like I was saying, I had the opportunity to buy them for $300 and I didn't, so that sucked. Great Britain, let's get some Great Britain stuff in here. Quite a few number fours in the list, between $500 and $600. Some of them were just under $500 at $450, but they were post-war production, so they were like late 40s, early 50s production. So they were number four Mark I stars. I don't know all the fucking details here. They were talking in the Discord the other day. I know Frantic remembers this conversation. About how the Carcanos are just a fucking nightmare in terms of keeping track of all the models. And then somebody was like, the Dutch have stepped into the chat. And I'm like, yes, of course, the Dutch bullshit is still also crazy. I wanted to post a meme of like two guys fighting while Great Britain sitting in the corner like, nobody's talking about us. Just fucking nightmare in terms of what model is what.
The Enfields are tough.
Yeah, so like, yeah.
You guys said anything about the Kirkanas? The Kirkanas are pretty simple, but the Enfields are, I don't know anything about the naming system for those.
Somebody, I think, got a pretty good deal. There was a 1918 SMLE. It was not matching, but $500. It was in decent shape. I think that's a pretty good deal, in my opinion, a World War One SMLE.
I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but I've noticed like prices of Enfields like softening a bit. They just aren't pulling quite as much money unless there's something really special. But kind of the run of the mill, like number one Mark Threes and stuff like that, don't seem to be pulling as much as I thought they were a couple of years ago.
The highest Great Britain rifle was an SMLE with 1914 date on it, 750. So if you found a Gewehr 98 1914 date, I don't think that would go for 750. If it was the same condition and same like overall thing, I think the Gewehr 98 would go for more money.
Yeah, for sure.
Like I think, like you're saying, I think like it's definitely not as strong as others in terms of that. None of the number fours exceeded 600, except for one. It was a U.S. property marked Savage production number four. So that said, it was special. So that one was 650. So I don't see anything sticking out here in terms of Great Britain. There was a weird one. There was supposedly an SHTLE, so the Shortley Enfield, I think that's what that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which was supposedly Iraqi marked. It was, I don't know, the listing was super weird and very sketch, but that went for 550. I don't know anything about that, if that was legit or not, but that one was weird. There was a couple of Gewehr 88s that showed up, Turkish marked, and they stuck at the bottom. So
yeah,
$280. That is the so far the winner for the bottom of the barrel in terms of prices. You could 1938 conversion of the Turkish Gewehr 88, $280 to your door. Funnily enough, there was a couple of Swedish guns down there. Oh, about that, Danny. Some M94s came at the bottom of the list. I don't know why. I found another one. Another deal, I think, too. So we'll switch to Russia real fast. Some Imperial M91s did show up, and some post-war Russian stuff did show up, some 9130s and some post-war M91-59s were there, but there was what I think was the deal that somebody got was a really nice condition a 1917 M91 that was Remington for $400, so... I think somebody got a really good deal on that one. I don't believe it was matching. It might have been forced matched, but still, I think that you did pretty well in terms of that. As far as the rest goes, under 500 still, exception being some the M44s all are still going 500 plus for the most part. But those have kind of not really moved up. In terms of price, I've not really seen them. Those have kind of stayed in the $500 to $600 range as long as I've really been looking at them. Maybe the last 5 or 6 years, they've not really moved a lot. There was the highest Russian rifle was the Sniper. We assume it's original Sniper. It says it was, but there was a Finnish capture Imperial M91 from 1916, which went for 650. So that was pretty normal. Let's see, looking at here, French MOS 4956 went for 800 to 900. I don't know enough about French stuff to know if that's a good deal or not. wasn't a whole lot of French stuff in the list, to be honest. A Berthier went for 450, 1918 marked. I thought that was pretty good. It was the five shot, not the three shot. So I believe it was ball in. So it was updated. Bottom of the list, though, still dominated by Spain, Turkish, Yugo, M48s, M48A, 450 or less.
Okay.
Dutch M95. The only M95 on the fucking list was a Dutch one. For $450. M91 30s, 450 or around there. Gewehr 1889, the Swiss long rifle, 350. Didn't get much money for that one. But yeah, so bottom of the list is pretty much the ones that we would expect to be down there still.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't seem to be much movement up price-wise with a lot of the guns at the bottom. Like, a little bit. Like, maybe Turk stuff is gone up a little bit, Turkish. And but, like, a lot of Spanish-made stuff, not a whole lot other than, I think, 1916s have. It just seems like people that get into that kind of thing maybe tend to collect them a little more. And plus, they can't stay $99 forever, you know, so they kind of go up.
No, yeah. To discuss outside of Gunbroker, outside of my data set, a lot of the Italian market and Austro-Hungarian M95 market, and then some of the French antique market is being utterly destroyed right now by RTI, even though they're in pretty rough condition for the most part. They're offering insane amounts of value for some of this stuff that would normally be extremely hard to find. The Carcanos less so because those are tend to be more common, but the French antiques, the Gras, the Chassepot, the Labels they had, those are a lot harder to find, and they were offering insane discounts in terms of that, that just are not on the market very often. And then the M95 market, if you have an original rifle and you paid a decent amount of money before the RTI stuff, you've lost money. It's not gonna recover yeah. anytime soon. They're selling them for $100 a piece, fucking sake. You know, it's just not it's not gonna be a thing. And I've also advised people too on Reddit a couple times here in the past week or so. They were talking about potentially buying some and flipping them. I don't see that happening. They tend to be in not good enough condition to flip, and then the market is just not there. The market for M95s especially has been pretty stagnant just for the last 10 years, just because the lack of availability in ammo, and just in terms of they're just not popular. When Battlefield 1 actually caused a surge in M95 popularity.
That's funny.
And it legit did. And most of the time when I've met people that have like, oh, I know what an M95 is from Battlefield 1, that's where they learned it from, is because in that game, it was listed as a sniper rifle, and it was actually pretty broken as a sniper rifle. So it was one of the most common used weapons in the game, so they know about it. And it did cause a bump in the prices, but it's not sustained. After that game has fallen off, the prices have started to come back down. I still see those for $300 to $500 for an M95 30, 34. Long rifles tend to go for $500+. Before RTI, the original caliber rifles, you would be expecting to pay $500 to $600 going up in terms of price and in terms of condition. But now that RTI is here, that market's just fucking gone. It's just destroyed. So if you have an original yeah. long rifle or original Stutzen that you paid the original amount of price for, it's the value's gone.
What did you say you paid? Like the cheapest you paid for one from RTI?
$150.
$150. So like, I've still see them at shows. People want $400 and $500 because I guess in their mind that's maybe what they went for. Or you saw some sold for or whatever 10 years ago. But it's like, yeah, when you can get them for $150, $200, you know, it's a little rough for that price. But like, dude, your gun's gotta be real nice to demand, you know, 2-3 times the price of, you know, whatever nice one goes.
And RCI does tend to, you tend to be gambling. You're going to be gambling in terms of condition and missing pieces, especially. But
I see that a lot with Garcanos too. You can get them 150, as low as $100 from RTI. And then I'll go and I'll see people selling them like the, not the long rifles, but the, Moscatos. They'll go want $500-$600 for them. It's weird. It's like, dude, I can just go buy one right now for
it's undermining the market, but it's not showing up yet in terms of the overall market has not noticed the softening, I don't think, or at least these people at the shows have in their heads, they've been like, well, this is what this was going for, so now it still needs to go that way. But the availability, there's still a lot of people that don't know about RTI. And but for the large collectors, I would definitely say that it's definitely softening the market for those particular ones. But like we said, the rest of the stuff that's not RTI, Yugoslavian stuff tends to still have been downgraded. It was going up pre-pandemic. I think we were noticing that, but not really moved much anymore. M9130s, we were discussing this with Jake earlier, but they went up in price. They're much more expensive than they used to be, but they're not continuing to move up. They're not trending upward at all anymore. Earlier Swiss stuff, the early pre-K31s have kind of stopped. They seem to have plateaued in the $500-$600 range or less. K31s are also seeming to have plateaued or maybe kind of fallen a little bit. I think the fervor that hit for K31s was maybe like 2019, 2018, where they just suddenly just exploded in value. But I think that's starting to soften. I don't know if that's because they just keep coming in. You still see Edelweiss, you still see Simpson, but they're still selling them too for the $600-$700 range. But they're not really going up beyond that range for that much. They're kind of stuck in that range.
As long as they keep bringing them over, it'll probably help. But I think too, I think somebody said they're getting more expensive in Switzerland now, and probably in part because we're bringing them. Everyone's all these different companies are just exporting all these.
The gentleman we had on from Switzerland has mentioned to us that he hates the American importers because they're stealing all the Swiss guns.
I mean, they're a small country. They didn't, you know, they only made a relatively small amount of these things that we're bringing in.
So that's the European.
Who was it? Was it Samuel that said that most of the stuff though was like the rougher rifles?
It definitely seems like it's getting exported to be the lower end of the barrel in terms of quality. I know that we talked about this before, but one of the importers brought in ones without magazines, right?
Yeah, yeah, they were really cheap. They were like $400 or something like that for
no magazines. So that's super weird. Because
when they brought those in, the magazines disappeared, like the handful that were like out there.
Yeah. So anybody that doesn't know, it's really weird for a K31 to be not matching. So that's an oddity in the MIL-SERP community, because it's usually much more rare for it to be matching than non-matching. And it's the opposite for K31s. It's much more weird for it to be non-matching than matching. So for them to have a big group come in without matching magazines, that is a signal that there's some bottom of the barrel shit coming in.
I think that's starting to change. I think more and more of them that are being imported are either without mags or mismatched when they're being imported.
I think you're starting to get to definitely a bottom of the barrel, or they're trying to keep it at the same price point and therefore having to get lower quality.
Oh, yeah, that could be what's happening. Yeah,
because what will happen is, especially with the importers, is they'll start fighting with each other and start trying to, because there's only a limited number of exporters in Switzerland. They'll start competing with each other for prices. But if they do that, then they'll price themselves out of the market. So they're trying to, I think, either either got a couple of options. We're running out of parts, running out of guns, or they're trying to keep the same price point roughly, but therefore having to dip the quality down. So who knows? But that's Europe. I want to move on to Middle East and Africa. I do have some. That's Asia.
I'm going to go ahead and say it. For the Middle East, the Turks got to be have to have the best value rifles out there.
Oh, obviously, yes.
From the group that you and I are in, Aaron, Sam on there, he collects Turkish stuff. And you know, it's interesting, like I don't understand it. I don't quite super collect Turkish stuff, and it doesn't make sense to me why I don't. Because a lot of it, I like conversion guns. Like I like guns that have been like updated and converted and stuff like that. I think it's really cool when militaries do that, and I tend to collect that. That's like all that Turkish guns are for the most part, is like converted and updated older guns. But
because they just kept it all.
Yeah, yeah. Like they're 1893s that they, you know, updated and stuff like that. So I don't know. They're just not a big thing to collect for most people. But for Sam, he happens to like them. And so, you know, it's cool. And like, if you can make yourself like something and collect something, I think Turkish Mausers might be a really good one.
But yeah, the Turkish stuff was at the bottom of the barrel in terms of price. There was 129 long rifles that I found in my listings and my data. Their places are 121, 124, 126, and 129. So the bottom of the price. The bottomest price was a $225 M1938 1940-year Turkish Mauser. So it was not in horrible condition. It was not like an RTI special, but it just does not command the value. The most expensive was a similar condition 1942 manufacture M1938 for $400. So $400 or less still gets you a pretty good condition Turkish Mauser. That's going to be an 8mm Mauser. Once again, if you find a 7.65 Turkish Mauser, that's going to skyrocket the price.
The Ottoman stuff is crazy. Yeah.
If you find specific things from Turkish or Ottoman Mausers, skyrocket the price. It's a totally separate market. But for some reason, the Turkish stuff is just still depressed in terms of value. Egypt, we had a couple of Egyptian guns show up. Hakim for $800, which is, I think, on the low end.
Yeah. Yeah, they can run. They can be kind of rough or whatever. So just depending on what it's.
Yeah. RTI is also undermining the Hakim market slightly. They had quite a few of the low-grade ones come out. They were pretty rough. Some of the ones that I saw, one of the ones that I think might have been my favorite thing I've ever seen, was they had cut the stock down to the fore end, and instead of it being, because they couldn't put a band on it, it was one of those adjustable metal-strapped bands with a screw in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was what was holding the stock together. So that was a C-grade Hakim that was for $400, I think, $450 maybe or something like that.
I saw a pretty good condition Hakim sitting at a gun shop for $800 for a while. No one picked it up, so.
They're really neat guns. I'm surprised they don't have a higher price point, but I think it's just because they're Egyptian.
I think people are scared of them. The people that know enough about them are like, oh no, I don't want to get hurt by this gun. And then they might be unsure of the quality, being that it's Egyptian or whatever. And you can find some pretty good values in Hakims right now.
We'll say that's probably right, that people get a little scared of them just because they are to date the only gun that if I pick it up, I cannot figure out intuitively how to operate it. They're a little wonky. So
yes. Like if you had no idea how to operate it, you'd look and go like, what the, like, okay, where's the handle? Like, where's the charging handle? Like, how do you think? Yeah. It's not super intuitive.
I've even watched YouTube videos on how to operate a Hakim, and still, if I ever see one in person, I wind up getting confused. It's just weird.
You have to play with one, and it sort of clicks how it works, but it's not like crazy.
It's definitely
some people choice. See me play around, like how you close the bolt, because like the bolt locks back, and then like, well, how do you close it? And people do weird things, like take the magazine out and then slam it forward and whatever. But like, I always do this funny thing because I'll do it and I'll kind of watch the person's face while I do it, because they're like, oh, because they'll see me stick my fingers like in the magazine where normally the bolt would go forward, but I know it's being retained. And I show it in my videos, because it's sort of like one of my pet peeves is people like thinking that the Hakims or Jungmans are super, super dangerous. They're going to smash your fingers when, I don't think they're that bad. If it's only dangerous if you have the magazine out, which the magazine is supposed to be in, you know, when you're operating it, and, or if the bolt hold back, detent is broken or whatever, which, and I've said this before, but, Alex on TFB TV, his old Jungmann video, his rifle that the detent was missing or it was malfunctioning, and it wasn't holding the bolt back on the last round like it should be, and he didn't realize it because like it wasn't his gun, so like he just kind of was like, oh, this is dangerous, and he kind of wore a glove, and it's like, yeah, because your gun's malfunctioning, like it's broke, like that's why it seems dangerous.
Danny, were those stripper clip fed, or were those supposed to be swapping the magazines?
Yeah, you're not supposed to. Yeah, they were stripper clip fed.
So I noticed that too. It happens a lot with U.S. stuff, is people don't realize that they're not supposed to swap the magazines out. So people try to swap magazines out, and then you start to get issues like you're talking about, where people smash their fingers because they're not doing something that the rifle was designed to do.
Yeah, exactly. This is a Jungmann here. So basically all Jungmanns in the United States are they're upgraded. They were updated in the 50s. So they're all like AG-42Bs. They added these little like dimples on the
gripper
to kind of help you. Yeah, if you want to know what the AG-42 looked like before the B upgrade program, just look at a Hakim. It's pretty much they looked like Hakims. So they didn't have this bolted on thing. But part of the upgrade program was this little top piece here on the front part of, well, it's on the top because I'm holding it this way, but it's on the front piece of the magazine, and that's just to help retain the magazines to make them less easy to remove from the guns, because again, these are supposed to stay in the gun. So part of the B upgrade program was actually to make it even harder to stick the magazine out of the gun. But yeah, it's a fixed 10 round magazine, and again, I'll say that this is, a lot of people think that like the Jungmann was supposed to replace. A lot of people will falsely say that the Jungmann was supposed to replace all bolt actions in the Swedish military, but it wasn't. This was supposed to just augment the firepower. Just one of these was supposed to be given out like per squad, and it was just supposed to raise the, you know, the firepower of the whole squad. But yeah, that's pretty much it. You just look for a couple little basic things with your guns, and this is a thing I like to. I like to sort of do for people. If you want to know about your bolt staying back or whatever, we'll get into it. We'll do this in another episode. This is the wrong episode to get into this. I'm digressing.
All right. The other Egyptian thing that showed up was an FN-49. These are the most common FN-49 that show up in the United States. They also tend to be the cheapest. It was about $1,000 on that one. That seems to be what they go for anymore. There was a couple of at the show when we were there with Danny, and they were around that same price range. An odd thing that showed up on GunBroker in my data set was a Persian Mauser model 9829. That went for about $1,000. I do not know prices on those. Those aren't out of my area of expertise.
I think that's about right.
Roughly. Okay. I did not see anything wrong with it, but that's out of my knowledge base. So So as we've discussed, it seems like Middle Eastern stuff tends to be undervalued or priced low in terms of that. The thing you're going to run into is a lot of it is a rough. It's going to be, you're going to struggle to find good condition, I would say. You're going to find mostly rough to fair condition stuff. Doesn't mean it's bad, but you're going to struggle to find good to excellent condition just because, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's been a lot of conflict in the Middle East in the last 70, 80 years. So,
what
shit got used? If you ever wanted a rifle that you're going to be pretty sure shot somebody, I would get a Middle Eastern one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing too. I've heard people they justify the high prices of certain European rifles as, well, this was used in a war. It's like, well, that doesn't always work for certain guns, because, you know, you can get a Turkish gun, and I guarantee you that's probably been shot in anger, you know, or some of these Middle Eastern guns, you know.
For sure. But, all right, we'll move into Asia here just a second. So obviously the big country in Asia is going to be Siam with the Siamese Mausers. Come on, guys. What? No? No? All right, fine. It's Japanese. All right, fucking all Japanese. Fucking Type 99s, Type 38s, and all this other bullshit. All right, so these are all over the fucking place. I cannot make heads or tails of this fucking market.
Yeah, no, dude, it's going to be way too hard just to broad strokes this, because it's like...
If you are a Japanese collector, I salute you, because I don't understand this shit at all. We are all over the fucking place in terms of price. I found Type 99s with the full mum for about $1,000. There's about three or four of those in that range. And then all the way at the fucking bottom of that list, there's a full mum Type 99 for $450. I don't fucking understand this. They looked very similar in terms of condition. I don't know if there was a particular maker or series or something like that matching what. I didn't do all that information. These are very particular in terms of, like, you got to know the maker, the series, if it has all of the right stuff for that series, like if it's got the... So they... I don't know all this, but at certain points, features started to disappear. So you had your anti-aircraft sights started to disappear. You had certain things are starting to be different later on down the road. So I don't know all of its particulars, but if it's matching and correct and the mum, that tends to be premium value. But you have to know what you're looking for that to be premium value. Otherwise, it's just a 99. So
there's so much to know with those. Yeah. Because it's like, oh, actually, that's a 22nd series Nagoya Arsenal. And that one shouldn't have had the bipod. Should have been... It's like, yeah, no, it gets too into the nitty gritty.
This is for sure
features that could have been omitted or whatever.
This is for sure the greatest range of the same model gun that I had in value mm-hmm. prices here. You had between $1,000 and $400. That's the same model. So if you don't know, you really need to research if you're trying to get specific things, or you're trying to find or trying to become a Japanese collector, you really need to get some kind of literature or some heavy knowledge on what specific you're going to be looking for, because these are all over the place in terms of value. The same with the Type 38s, less common on the gun broker listings, but about $900 down to $500. So, and that's with mum and without mum. They're all in that range. Defaced mums still went for $800. I don't know if it was a particular maker or something or other that is bringing the value up. I do not know. There was only one last ditch that I did find that was completely last ditch. We're talking wood butt plate, sling holes, like holes in the stock for the rope.
Oh, you see, now that's a sought after feature.
Yeah, but that one was $700. So I don't know if that's a good price.
The rope, it probably is. The rope hole is something that the guys look for because that's a super last ditch sort of thing.
Yeah, this one was rough. This for sure was.
Yeah, so if you have a Type 99 last ditch, what you do is you drill a hole in the stock, and that'll double your money.
Make sure you just bore it out with a fucking spoon.
Yeah, just a random drill.
All right. Now, we did have some other Asian countries show up in this list on the rifles. We had some Chinese stuff show up. A Chinese SKS, which went for...
That's a whole thing like you could get into right there.
$750 for a Chinese SKS. I don't know if it was a particular model or year or commercial or what. It was just $750. There was something that Danny would have been interested in, which was a Chinese conversion of Type 38 to 7.62 by 39. That went for $550. That is very cheap.
Yeah, I think that's good.
That was a good deal. That's definitely the good deal for the Asian side for sure. And then there was a couple of Type 53s, which are still depressed in value. They are still under $500. They are down in the bottom $300 to $400 for Type 53s. For those that don't know, that is the Chinese copy of the M44. I think they were made on original M44 manufactured, like the dies and stuff. So like the Soviets sold them the production equipment. So it wasn't like they copied it. They actually sold them the correct production equipment. The most expensive one went for $400, and it was a 1954 dated Type 53. So that's pretty cool. It's a very early one. And then stuff that normally wouldn't think of, but India is Asia. So I have India listed here. The cheapest rifle in the Asia category was an Indian SMLE. And that was a wire-wrapped grenade rifle, very rough condition, but it did come with the grenade cup, and it was $230. So the Indian,
that sounds about right. Yeah.
The Indian SMLEs are going to tend to be pretty rough, and they tend to also be undervalued in terms of they're not going to have very much high value on those. Now, something that did bring a decent amount of money, which I was surprised about. That was Indian, was 2A1s. There was a couple of 2A1s that showed up. Now, these are the new built rifles in the 50s and 60s from India that look like SMLEs, but are actually different. They are in 7.62 by 51. Those went for around $500 to $550, which I thought was a decent amount for the Indian rifles. They tend to not bring a lot of money. But the 2A1s are semi-popular in the United States because they are in a much more common round, and they still look like a SMLE. So you have an advantage there. We did have a couple of Siamese Mausers show up for the exact same price, $400 for both of them.
Yeah.
Totally different bids, totally different sellers. One had 17 bids.
Did they have mums?
No, they didn't have mums. They have chokums. I can't ever pronounce the stupid thing.
Yeah, see, that's why they didn't go for much. They didn't have the mums.
No, you're right. I did originally start this without listing the mums, and then I was like, oh, fuck, I can't do that. So I have to go back and find out whether or not it has mums or not, because I thought that would dictate prices. It fucking doesn't. It's all over the place. Who knows? The mum is...
Yeah, that's kind of weird. Because, like, in person, that's the first thing everybody looks at. When you see...
You know why it is? Up,
You flip it over to look for the mom. That's like the first thing.
It's the easiest thing to figure out first. Yeah, that's so. That's your easiest value indicator is going to be the mom. And then you can
like move you look on. At the price. You look at the mom, look for a mom, and then look at the price.
Well, and then you look at the manufacturer, then you look at the series, and you look at the features, and then you do all the other stuff. The mom is the easiest value indicator, and that's what it is. I thought that would dictate higher prices. Now, the top five Type Tiny Nines had full moms. So, yes, it did seem to indicate a value added, but like I said, the lowest Type 99 had a no mom for $420, and the next one up had a full mom for $450. So, it's not as much of a price value indicator as you would expect it to be, but it is a thing.
It could be, yeah.
Here's the thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. My buddy that just joined our Discord on gun boards, I guess their Japanese section is pretty intense, but people are they starting to fake mums now?
Well, I've not heard this.
Oh, I saw somebody that did. Yeah. They restamped a mum.
Oh, really?
Add that to another country of faked and fraudulent stuff. People might be starting to do that to add a couple $100 to your gun. And probably people aren't suspecting that as much as the German or other stuff. Just yeah,
that's true.
Interesting side note
that would
for
be
my buddy,
hard
actually.
To do, I would think, because the defaced ones were particularly hard removed. So you're going to have like a defaced section beside the mom. So,
well, yeah. I mean, my first Type 99 has it partially defaced. So, I mean, it's partially grand, which my wife and I, we kind of are interested in that story of like what happened with that gun versus the guns that were completely ground. Obviously they had tons of time to do that versus the ones that was like last minute. Obviously let's literally take a Dremel tool of some sort back then. I mean, a very old Dremel tool, they kind of partially ground it. And then I have a Type 38 with a full mom, but I'm not exactly sure how to fake that stuff, but apparently people are doing that.
I think the collectors refer to it as like an overstamped, but there's different like shades of defaced mums, but there is the completely like ground off, you know, huge sort of, you know, grounding marks and everything like that. I think that was more of like sort of guns maybe that were in storage somewhere that had to be like they had the facility set up to do that and they were just cranking them out doing that. That seems to be very common. It looks like a single sort of pass and they were just doing that all day. And then there's the guns that are just like, they're like dinged a couple of times, like they're X'd out. There's
yeah,
that kind of thing that looks like it was more done in the field sort of thing.
Right.
Those could be like a surrender sort of piece where they just dinged them out and turned them in.
Like last minute, like they considered that mum the symbol of their demigod, right? The emperor. So, I mean, it was a almost holy symbol.
I think it was part of the surrender, though, wasn't it? It was
MacArthur's. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't want to surrender the symbol of your, I mean, demigod or
well, I think
emperor.
It was part of the. I think it was part of the surrender documentation that it wasn't that necessarily that the Japanese didn't want to surrender it. It was like MacArthur's way of saying, "No, he's not. Like you're done." Like you are defacing this, which you normally would never have done. So this is like for sure you guys are done, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I've heard that a lot before of like it's their that was a symbol of their emperor. That's why they ground it off so we wouldn't get it sort of thing. But also I've thought about it like if it is sort of like a quasi holy symbol to them. Then defacing it, isn't that sort of like a...
That's what I mean. That's why it was like, I believe it was more of a MacArthur US thing where it was like, you are defacing this because you are not to ever like want to do this ever again, that kind of thing. Like you are never to do this again.
Maybe it was painful for them to do. And so
it would be like, I don't know, like a Christian symbol, like a cross on your, like an Israeli Mauser or something. And you like, you had to grind it off before you had to get rid of it. And it's like that kind of idea is that you are like, we are giving this up entirely. That's what that's what that is symbolizing in terms of that. That's what
I had heard that too about the transfer. That was kind of I forgot where I heard that though. Part of the official surrendering that they did, but the fact that there's very well done groundings and then partial, it is interesting to me. And I don't know the whole history of the differences of that, but yeah.
I did not get into the highest sold Japanese rifle, and that was a paratrooper type 2. That went for $2,600. And that did have no mum. Now, I would not say it was no mum, actually. It was defaced. This was a defacing of the mum down the center. So it was essentially like somebody had, like you said, Danny, a machine set up for Dremeling, and they just rubbed it down the middle, and it was like all the way down the top of the receiver bridge, and then they put it off to the side, and that went for $2,600. Now, I thought that was expensive for no mum, but I guess the guys in the Discord have been following those, and that seems to be about the price actually nowadays. So that's a very high-end Japanese collector rifle is the paratroopers. That's some interesting news on that one. Moving over to the handguns, it's all Japanese all day, almost exclusively Type 14s, the large ones, around 850 to 700, just in terms of price, not much variation. All pretty much the same condition-wise. Although one of them in the higher price range, in the $800 price range, did have a original holster. So I'm sure that helped bolster the price a little bit. But we're looking between $700 and $800 for the Type 14s. Type 94 surrender pistols. The ones you can shoot with your... with the sear exposed, right, Danny?
Yeah, that's the
most dangerous pistol.
Suicide pistol, yeah.
Most dangerous handgun ever created.
I heard someone recently just say that they wouldn't even want to own them because they're not safe. Because they can be fired without pulling the trigger. So I don't even want to own one.
Actually, they're incredibly safe. Somebody let me try to shoot one at a range, and as soon as I pulled the trigger, it just didn't work, and then back it up and take it home, and he couldn't even get the open or the slide to open, so I couldn't even make one shoot.
Yeah. So those are still bottom of the barrel in terms of Japanese handgun price, as one would expect. They are well known in the FUD community as being garbage and dangerous, so they are still depressed in value. You were still expecting about $500 to $600 for one of those, which is for a World War II handgun. That's pretty cheap for, especially a major power.
Yeah, a lot of variables though.
Yes, as Danny said, the Japanese stuff is a lot of variables, all over the place. Yeah.
Like my 94, I took it to the range the first time, and you know, put a loaded mag in it, racked around, and just pulled the trigger, click. That's it. Don't know why. So. I still haven't really investigated, so it's like a real hit or miss.
Now,
I found with the older generation, every Japanese handgun is the suicide pistol, right? That's everything I've ever heard. Oh, you got a suicide pistol. I actually don't have that one, but...
Yeah.
Now, something that I didn't know about being a highly desired model of handgun for Japan... are the revolvers. So the Type 26 revolver was actually the highest priced handgun for Japan at $950. It had 35 bids on it. Actually, it was the most bid on Japanese handgun that I found in my data set. And so I don't know much about these. I don't know if Danny or Frantic or Cody or Jack.
Jake.
Jake, sorry, I call you Jack all the time.
Either one.
I don't know if you guys know, but I didn't know this was a thing, but I was talking with some of the people in the Discord, and I guess the Japanese revolvers tend to go for a little bit more money. I guess there's more of a following for them. Not as many made, apparently, is what the big thing is. There's only It's only about 50 to 60,000 made, but they tend to go for more money. They also somewhat, at least from the data set that I looked at, they tend to be in pretty good shape, pretty good condition. So, but those are going to be between 9 to 1,000. At least what's going on here. The Japanese market is, as we discussed, all over the fucking place. So there's no consistency here.
Frantic and I are going to have to take off here pretty soon. I don't know if you want to wrap it up.
Oh, yeah, we can wrap it up. We'll go through real fast the just brief overview of everything. American market, still fucking insane for prices. 1917s tend to be okay price-wise, but if you're going to buy anything, buy from the CMP. South American tends to be undervalued in terms of price for the Mausers. Specific models, though, are very expensive, and it does seem like some of the models are coming up in prices, as some people are starting to notice the South American Mausers are very high quality. Some of the 7.65 stuff is still depressed in value because that's not a very common round in the United States. In Europe, in the European market, the SMLEs and number 4s tend to be not moving up in price very much. The French stuff also kind of depressed. The German stuff still fucking expensive as hell. I did not mention that one of the K98Ks that went for $900 was a Mitchell's Mauser. 1937 Mitchell's went for $900. So somebody got fucked there. Swedish stuff tends to be a little bit of a range there as well, but tends to be on the higher end. Italian stuff, Austro-Hungarian stuff we've discussed is fucking depressed because of RTI. Spanish stuff also tends to be on the low end just because of the overall quality and condition that they show up in and the general sentiment of them in the market. Middle Eastern, Turkish stuff is still low end, low grade, low reputation. Egyptian tends to be low end as well in terms of reputation, but they tend to be better production, at least in better quality and better general condition overall. Back in Asia, the Indian stuff tends to be low end in terms of condition and value, but there's some of the 2A1s are going up in value, it seems. China, the Type 53s are still low end in terms of value. They also tend to be in pretty rough shape. Most of the Chinese guns you're going to find are in pretty rough shape. It's not like they didn't do anything for the last 250 years. Japan, that market is, as we said, all over the fucking place. Who knows? You got to know what you're getting into if you're going to buy something. If you're going to spend a lot of money, you better know what you've got. Because that market is just all over the place. So if somebody's trying to sell you a $1,000 Type 99, you better know what you're doing. It might be worth it, but it might not be. Who knows? So that's about where we're at in terms of the MilSERP market for 2023. That was just a quick overview. I didn't get into specific models as like down to the very nitty gritty, but the K98Ks obviously are still way up there for some fucking reason. The overall stuff, I think we've got a good explanation here. Thanks to everybody for joining us today. And I think we'll just to go ahead and sign off. Everybody, unless you got something else to say.
Question for Danny. On the 96 Swedish Mausers, threaded versus unthreaded muzzles, how does that affect the value?
Threaded kind of kills it.
Right.
It probably knocks off like at least $100, something.
It might explain why there was some of the Swedish guns at the bottom of the list. Mm-hmm. I did not specify that in my notice, but there was Swedish rifles at the bottom of the value list.
Yeah. It's going to happen about that because mine's threaded. It was a good deal at a gun show, but I mean, I just happened to pick it up.
They're more common to be threaded.
It's legit. It seemed for 96s. it seems to be like half and half, something like that. Just from anecdotally from what I've seen, most M38s are threaded. So it's harder to find a non-threaded M38. So yeah, it does hurt the value a little bit. A lot of people tend to not know what the threading is and assume it's above it sort of thing. But, it dings the value a little bit for sure. Yeah. But it's part of the B upgrade program. So.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Cody, cool. You got anything else?
I have got nothing else. No, I think it was good.
All right, everybody. Thanks to y'all for coming. And, be sure to check out MilSERP World on YouTube. We have a Patreon where you can join for as little as $1. $1. And that'll get you access to our Discord server, which you can use to yell at me about the M95s.
Yeah. Cody here is the Archduke of the Discord server.
Yes, Cody is treat him as the royalty Archduke.
That he is.
Cody is officially the Archduke as...
I created a Patreon level just for him. So he's technically other people could join it. I guess you might have to share that. Nobody else is going to do that. I didn't make the Le Emperor or whatever for Frenchie, but I don't think anybody's enough. That's more for the lols. But cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for joining the podcast.
Yeah, I think we're going to have another one here probably pretty soon to discuss with some FFLs and how that market's going.
What it's like on that end.
What's it like to be a MilSERP FFL?
I kind of feeling that's going to just turn into what it's like to be an FFL and then an ATF bitch session, which might be fun on its own, right? So we'll see.
All right. Thank you all. And talk to you guys later.
Okay. Bye. All right.